in the slides, you might have noticed I've been doing most of that on the board. But I can, yeah, I can get them. Sure, yeah, okay. Anything else? Okay, so everybody knows there's more problems online and they're due this day week, next Tuesday. Okay. Okay, so today we were going to talk about quantum computing, and we will, but because we had to rush a bit at the end of the last lecture, I just want to go over a couple of points. So just the idea of the BB84 protocol that we talked about, I just mentioned very quickly again. The idea is that Alice can encode her information in any one of two bases, and she chooses at random which bases to use, which gives four non-orthogonal states that she sends to Bob. And because they're non-orthogonal, it makes it difficult for an eavesdropper. So when Bob gets them, he decides at random which bases to measure in, and if the basis he chooses agrees with the basis Alice chose, then they should get the same result, so they should share information. If the basis he chooses doesn't agree, then they get random. He gets a random result, and it doesn't agree. So after they've made all the measurements, they communicate over a public channel, and it's called basis reconciliation. They discuss what basis they used, so they know when the bits should coincide. And as I said, the idea is that because the states are non-orthogonal, if an eavesdropper tries to do something, to figure out what states are being sent, she can't determine with certainty. And so she always introduces errors in the bit string. And Alice and Bob at the end can check a subset of their shared bit string and make sure that it does really all agree. And we talked a little bit about, well, if Eve could be a bit clever, somebody asked, what kind of, she could do some other kind of measurement and maybe introduce less error into the bit string. And I just want to give you a quick demonstration that whatever Eve does, she always has to introduce some disturbance into the signal. And let's suppose that she has just two non-orthogonal states that she wants to discriminate between. Well, what kind of things can Eve do? Well, any kind of measurement she makes will correspond to performing some unitary such that. So she starts off with some state psi or phi, and she has some state of her own, some other system. Just call that u. If she performs some unitary operation on these, then these can go to some other state v and phi v prime. And this is the most general sort of thing she can do. But because this has to be a unitary operation, because all she can do is unitary things, the overlap of her states afterwards has to be the same as before. So we get v psi. And that has to be the same as what it was before, which is u psi phi. And so if she doesn't want to introduce any disturbance into the states, so these don't change at all, the overlap is still the same, then this can't change either. And her states afterwards, v and v prime, are still the same, and there's nothing she can do to tell which state it was. So the idea is that whatever she does to try and find out some information about this, she inevitably introduces some disturbance into the states. And you can see that if these states were orthogonal, then this would be zero. And this would hold no matter what u and u prime and v prime were. So for orthogonal states, she can perfectly discriminate. But for non-orthogonal ones, she always introduces errors. And Alice and Bob can detect these errors. So we also talked at the end a bit about error correction and privacy amplification, but because that was quite rushed, I just want to mention a couple of points again. And the idea with the error correction is that, suppose Alice and Bob at the end share some bit string, but there's some errors in it. So Bob's bit string is the same as Alice's except for this one point. Well, they can divide it into subsets and communicate the parity of those sets. And the parity is just add up the number of ones in your string. And if it's an even number, the parity is one. If it's an odd number, the parity is zero. And if there's just one error, so this is Alice's and this is Bob's, well, the parity of Alice's string is 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. There's six ones, so the parity, it's even, so the parity is zero. But Bob's string has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, so his parity is one, okay. And in that way, they can detect that there's an error in this bit string. So they divide their shared bit string at the end of the protocol into subsets, and then they can find out where the errors are by using this. So if they find that there's an error in the bit string, then they half it, and they check this subset, and so on. And by the time they've done all that, they share supposedly a bit string without any errors. Okay? Any questions? Some people are looking at blank. Is that okay? Okay. And then finally, for privacy amplification, we haven't shown a complete proof, but just to motivate that whatever Eve does introduces some disturbance. And by measuring how many errors there are in the string, they can bound how much information Eve can have. And so they can use that to estimate how many bits roughly she knows. And then using privacy amplification, they can make sure that she has negligible information. And what they do is, for example, suppose they split up their string like this into twos and just calculate the parity of those. So this is 0 and 1, that bit becomes 1. This is 0 and 1, that bit becomes 1. 1 and 1, that bit becomes 0. And they use this as their shared bit string. And the idea is that even if Eve knew one of these bits, she doesn't know the other one, so she knows nothing about the parity. So in this way, they can reduce any information that Eve has. Okay, any questions? So we didn't really talk too much about the E91 protocol, and I did put a question about it, so I want to explain that in a bit more detail. The idea is that instead of Alice sending states to Bob, they share entangled states. So Alice and Bob share the singlet state. And Alice and Bob both choose at random in which of three possible bases to measure. And the bases they choose are so these correspond to your actual spin directions. So you remember we talked about the black sphere last week? These correspond to the state on the black sphere corresponds to the actual direction of a spin, so an electron spin or whatever. And if Alice and Bob Alice chooses one of these three bases to measure, and Bob chooses one of these three bases to measure. So if Alice chooses A1, Okay, zero. If Alice chooses A1 and Bob chooses B0, that's the same basis. So their information should be perfectly anti-correlated this time because it's the singlet state. And similarly, if Alice chooses A2 and Bob chooses B1, their information should be perfectly anti-correlated. If they choose different bases, then they're not correlated. But in the basis reconciliation, they tell each other which basis they used. And they then divide the bits into subsets of when they use the same basis and when they didn't use the same basis. And when they didn't, they can check the Bell inequalities. So this is something that you guys did with Owen. But these axes, let's see. I think it's, A0, A3, B0, and B3 correspond to the axes that give you the maximum violation of the Bell's inequalities. So by checking the bits that they don't use, the ones in which they use different bases, they can check whether they really violate the Bell's inequality maximally. So that's a check as to whether their states really were this entangled state. And if Eve has done something in the meantime, then they won't maximally violate the Bell's inequality, and they won't have that state. So this is a way they can detect the presence of Eve. Another way in which you can use entanglement for cryptography is Alice and Bob share entangled state at the start, and they proceed with essentially the BBH4 protocol, the one we talked about earlier. So they both choose at random in which basis to measure. And by choosing a basis and measuring in that basis, Alice projects Bob's system into the corresponding state on his side. So it's essentially identical to this protocol that we talked about before, except instead of actually preparing the states and sending them to Bob, Alice just makes a measurement on the EPR, on the Bell state, which collapses Bob into the state which he would have otherwise prepared. Is that clear? Okay. And so the last question on the question sheet from last week, I've changed a little bit, so it's not directly about the E91 protocol, it's just about an entangled protocol. So the one I just talked about, which is essentially equivalent to this one. Yes. Ah, okay. So the paper which originally proposed this was by Bennett and Brassard in 1984. And the paper which originally proposed this was by Arthur Eckert in 1991. And there's another protocol based on this one by Bennett in 1992, which is called the B92 protocol, which uses just two non-entangled states. And essentially, exactly for this reason, it's also secure against attacks by any shortcut. Okay. So that's all I wanted to say about cryptography. Have people tried the questions, and is that enough information to answer the questions? You can ask me afterwards if not. So I just want to remind you again of this black sphere representation, because I'll be talking about it in a little while. So for a pure state, the angles there correspond to like that, so it gets mapped onto a three-dimensional Lux sphere. Okay, so today we're going to talk about quantum computing. I just want to mention some classical things first before we get onto the quantum ones. Classical computing we can think of as being made up of a number of logic gates. So any classical computation you want to do, you can break down into just a number of classical logic gates. And these are just some examples that you're probably familiar with. So we'll just talk a little bit about two-value logic. So for example, the AND gate takes two bits, A and B, and gives you A and B. And it gives you a one if and only if A and B are both equal to one. The NAND, so the simplest one-bit operation is just the NOT. It just flips the bit. There are a number of two-bit operations, such as these. And then, for example, you have the NOT of them. So the NAND is just the NOT AND and so on. And these gates are not independent, so they can be written, some of them, in terms of other ones. For example, De Morgan's identities, you have like that. And so there's a finite set of gates which are actually universal for a classical computation. And the NAND gate and being able to copy any bit is universal for classical computation. So being able to do just those two operations allows you to do any classical computation. And we'll talk a little bit about what sort of operations you need to be able to do any quantum operation, quantum computation. And then we can have controlled logic gates. So this control NOT and the Toffoli. And one thing to notice about a lot of these gates are not reversible. So the AND and the OR, for example, take two bits and into one. And there's an energy cost associated with irreversible computation, because any irreversible computation, it has to be associated with an irreversible physical process. And if it's irreversible, it's associated with an increase in entropy, which has an energy cost, is also associated with an increase in a loss of energy, dissipation of energy. And so for a while, there were some papers and discussion about whether there was an absolute physical limit on what sort of computations could be done because there's this energy cost in irreversible computation. But in fact, any computation you can do classically, irreversibly, you can also do reversibly. And this Toffoli gate is a control NOT, which means, so in a circuit diagram, we have these three wires of three different bits. And this just denotes the control, and this denotes the NOT. So this bit gets flipped if and only if the first two are both one. And this gate is reversible. There's no information lost. You still have three bits at the end of it. And given the output, you can always reconstruct the input. So there's no, there doesn't have to be an energy loss associated with this. And so one of your homework problems is to show that most of these other logic gates, well, all of them in fact, can be constructed as special cases of the Toffoli gate. So that one gate of three bits is universal for classical computation. So quantum computing. Well, we talked about qubits and two-level systems and how they differ from classical bits. But just to state explicitly what properties a two-level system needs to have to be able to form a qubit. Well, you need to be able to manipulate it. So there are various constraints. So the first important thing is you need to be able to prepare the qubit in some initial state, which we call the fiducial state. And usually, that's just the zero state. So we have some basis, which we refer to as the computational basis, as I'm sure I've used the term already. And we usually talk about the fiducial state, the initial state of the system being the state zero. And then can do whatever we want with that. So that's the first thing. You need to be able to prepare the qubit in some initial state like that. The second thing is you have to be able to transform any state into any other state. So you need to be able to do any unitary transformation. And the idea, obviously, is that any information processing thing you want to do corresponds to some transformation of the state. So given some input state, you want to transform that in a certain way to give you an output state. And if you want to be able to do any such transformation, any such processing, then you need to be able to do any transformation of the state, so any unitary transformation. And the final requirement is that you need to be able to measure to get the information back out at the end. And it's sufficient that you can measure in the computational basis. And of course, if you can perform any unitary and measure in the computational basis, then you can measure in any basis. And you can see that as follows. So suppose you wanted to make a measurement in some other basis where phi 0 and phi 1 are orthogonal. Well, you can always perform some unitary which transforms from that basis to the computational basis. So suppose you wanted to measure the state of your qubit in this basis. Well, you can perform this unitary and then just measure in the computational basis. So if you make a measurement in the computational basis, the probability you get result zero but this is just exactly the probability you would have got if you measured it. Okay, so being able to perform any unitary transformation and just measuring the computational basis is enough to make any measurement. So that's what your system needs to satisfy in order to be a qubit. And in order to perform a computation, we think of several qubits. So what are the properties that a composite system needs to have to be able to perform a computation? Well, they're analogous, essentially, to the previous slide. You need to be able to prepare your computer in a well-defined initial state. And again, that's usually just the zero state. So now we have many qubits, and they're all prepared in the zero state. And you need to be able to do that well. And again, if you want to perform any computation, then you need to be able to perform any unitary transformation on this initial state. And finally, at the end of whatever algorithm, you need to be able to measure. So perform a measurement in the computational basis. So let's talk a bit about quantum logic gates. There are others, but these are the ones that I'm going to talk about. So analogously to the classical case, we have a quantum circuit model where you can express any quantum computation as some circuit. So you have wires coming out the side, and then you have various gates acting on them, and so on. And an important one that we talk about a lot is the Hadamard gate, which is just a unitary from the zero basis to the plus minus basis. So the Hadamard acting on the zero state just gives you a superposition. Like that. And the Hadamard acting on the one state just gives you the orthogonal superposition. So in the block sphere picture, you take the 0, 1 basis to what I've labeled the plus minus basis there. So it goes from the poles to the equator. And we can think about the matrix representation of operators. And a Hadamard operator looks like this. So, and the reason we use this a lot is because we usually start, as I've said, with the computer in the zero state, and then you apply the Hadamard to produce a superposition state. So what other kind of gates can we talk about? Any single qubit unitary can be represented in this way. So just a quantum system coming in from the left and being acted on with a unitary. Another gate I want to mention is the phase shift gate, which just introduces a phase between the zero and one components. And again, because it's nice to be able to visualize these things in the black sphere picture, this corresponds to a rotation about the zero axis. So this state goes to cos theta zero plus HVI 5 plus delta now. So it just corresponds to a rotation about the z-axis, about the zero. And the point is that the Hadamard and phase shift gate are sufficient to perform any unitary transformation on the qubit. And sort of qualitatively, you can see that in the black sphere picture, because the phase shift gate will take you anywhere on the latitude, whatever latitude your state is on. The phase shift gate would just rotate you around at that latitude. And the Hadamard gate works in the other way. So it takes you out of that plane. And so any unitary transformation you want to do can be made up of just those two gates. But of course, the phase shift is for any delta. So yeah.
We keep talking about the block sphere and stuff, but like, so the vector that represents the qubit?
Yes.
Okay. So when you operate on it using the operators that correspond to the logic gates, what exactly is, like, I know it's been a last course, but what exactly is the block sphere? Is that like just like the space that a qubit lives on? Like, is it just a very abstract notion? Like?
So for the case of a spin system, you have this idea that your spin can be up, down, in any number of directions. And then you have this kind of funny notion that you map that to a two-dimensional complex space. Well, the mapping is exactly the mapping from the block sphere to a two-dimensional complex space. What the block sphere is physically is the orientation in space of a spin system. So if I say something is pointing up on the block sphere, it means that a spin would spin in this direction. So it has a physical representation in that sense. And so, were you here last week?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a mapping. I mean, if you write the matrix representation of this state, the psi of psi, then you can show that there's a one-to-one mapping between the two-dimensional complex space and the three-dimensional real space. And because the vectors are constrained to have norm one, then they lie on the surface of the block sphere. And if it's a mixed state, then it lies in the interior of the block sphere. Okay. But yeah, so physically, I find it useful because for spin systems, it really corresponds to the direction of the spin points. Okay, and so the control NOT gate, which you asked about earlier, works exactly like in the classical sense. If the control qubit is in the state zero, it does nothing. And if the control state qubit is in the state one, it flips the target. So we start off with, let's just show how the C0 gate acts on all the states of the computational basis. So if we start off with two qubits, they can have this forms a basis for the two-qubit system. And the composite system can be in any one of these states or any superposition of these states. Now, the C naught acting on these states, well, if the first qubit is 0, it does nothing to the second, so it just remains 0, 0. And similarly here, it remains 0, 1. If the first qubit is 1, it flips the second qubit. Okay. And in the homework problem, I wrote the C naught. So if this is system A and system B, I don't know where. Like that. And that's just the formal way, the proper way, really, of writing exactly this transformation. So this acts on the first qubit, and these two operators act on the first qubit, and they check. So they check if the first qubit is 0, then this is the operator which should be applied. It does nothing to the second qubit. And if the first qubit is 1, then this is the operator which should be applied, which flips the second qubit. Okay. Is that clear for everyone? Yes. Okay. So if it's helpful, if the notation is confusing you in the problem sheet, then just use these relations. Okay. So we can talk a bit more generally about how it acts on superpositions. So if that was all there was to it, it would be exactly just a classical C naught gate. But because we can have superpositions, the C naught can actually create entanglement. And how that happens is as follows. So suppose now that the second qubit, in fact, I want the first qubit on there. Suppose the first qubit is in a superposition of 0 and 1. And the second qubit is in the state 0. Well, how does the C naught act on this state? We're just using exactly those four correspondences. Well, first of all, this is just 0, 0 plus 1, 0. And then the C naught. It does nothing to this one because the control qubit is in the state 0. And it flips this one. Okay. So we've gone from a state that was separable, so I could write this in terms of one state of the system A and one state of the system B, to a state which is entangled. So the C naught is also referred to as an entangling gate. It's not the only one. There are various most gates which have an interaction will, in fact, all gates which have an interaction will produce entanglement. So the C naught we can use to create these Bell states. Okay. So, and I think it's a bit different about quantum compared to classical. Is that the C naught, okay, let me show explicitly what happens if both of your qubits are in a superposition state. So I suppose the first one, oops. So both qubits are in a superposition state. Okay. So if both of you qubits start off in a superposition state like this, and you apply the CNOT gate, it's actually the first qubit that changes its state. So the second one ends up being invariant under this operation, while the first one flips from the plus state to the minus state. And so the role of target and control are interchanged. Yes?
You can use a CNOT gate as a way to get the Bell states. Mm-hmm. You mean like theoretically, but if we did it, if we sent like qubits down a wire, wouldn't it flip, not flip? Like, does this work physically?
Yes.
It works physically?
Yeah, it works physically. Yeah. So if you sent qubits down a wire and control, apply a CNOT, it flips or not flips, like you say. But because your input states can be superpositions, it both flips and not flips. Yeah. And that's exactly what's happening here. So you input a superposition state, and because the control qubit is in a superposition, the target qubit both flips in this sense and not flips over and flips and not flips. And you really can create entanglement like that. So for things like photonic systems, it's very difficult to do a CNOT. And so usually you start with an entangled pair, which is created by down conversion or something like I talked about in a previous lecture. But for things like trapped ions, you can create interactions which will perform a CNOT gate and create entanglement like this. And in fact, the control NOT gate, together with just single qubit unitaries, is universal for quantum computing. So the only interacting gate you need is the CNOT gate. So if you can make that and do anything on single qubits, then you're all free. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about some things that you're already familiar with to demonstrate the quantum circuit diagrams idea. And before I go into teleportation, I want to just talk about interference, because this is a very simple example. So suppose you have an interferometer. These are just beam splitters. So this is like a Mach Zehnder interferometer or something. Do you do much experimental work? Do you do much many experiments in your course, or is it mostly theoretical? Well, have you done a Mach Zehnder interferometer? Yes?
In secondary post, we did so a long time ago.
Okay. So the idea is, it's to show the wavelength nature of light. So you put in your light here, and the light beam splits at the beam splitter, and then recombines here. And you measure here and here. And if the lengths, the path lengths are balanced, then it all comes out at one detector. And if you stick a phase shift in here, then you can change the statistics at each detector. This is totally classical. And then if you do it at a single photon level, then it becomes a quantum experiment. So if you do it at a single photon level, you send in single photons here. And if path lengths are balanced, they always come out here. Even though it seems like if you talk about them being particles, then they should have an equal chance of coming out of either path at the end. And this touches on some of the things that I think Owen and Philip talked about with you guys. But you can think of this as the state that goes in here is your zero state. And at the beam splitter, it gets split. And half it goes this way and half it goes up. So if we now associate the zero and one basis with the different paths of the interferometer, then this beam splitter transforms the state to 0 plus 1. And then the second beam splitter does the same thing. So this is like what we just talked about. This is applying a Hadamard to the zero state. And the second one does exactly the same thing. It applies a Hadamard to what's also got a Hadamard. But this is self-inverse, so you just get the zero state like. And that's kind of a quantum computing way of showing why all of the particles come out of just one of the detectors. And so a quantum circuit for that is very simple. And you just... send in your zero state here, two Hadamards, and you just get the zero back. So I want to talk about teleportation now, because that's a concept we already talked about, and just to put it in the quantum circuit formalism. So let's follow the computation along from the left to the right. And this is also in one of your problems, so you might want to listen. The Q0 qubit corresponds to the state to be teleported. The Q1 corresponds to Alice's other state, and the Q2 corresponds to Bob's state. Okay, so they all start in the computational basis. Q0 starts in some state that you want to teleport. And then the other two start in the computational basis, 0 and 0. And this Hadamard gate on the Q1 transforms this as follows with the normalization. That. And this is exactly what I was just talking about. So the Hadamard followed by the C0 creates this entangled state. So on the next line, you have Q0, 1 over root 2. And now you have a Bell state between the qubits Q1 and Q2, which are Alice and Bob's qubits. So the next bit is to transform from the Bell basis to the computational basis between Alice's two qubits. We talked about this when we talked about teleportation. So, okay. Okay, so we went through all the algebra and we talked about teleportation. But this C0 and the Hadamard is just exactly the reverse of the first Hadamard and C0. So this takes from the computational basis to the Bell basis, and this does the reverse. So we now perform the Hadamard and C0 on these two qubits, and it performs a unitary from the Bell basis to the computational basis. And then Alice just measures in the computational basis, and the last part is just conditioned on the result of those measurements Alice, or Bob applies his unitaries. Okay, so this is exactly what we talked about when we talked about teleportation. Any questions? Okay. So the main thing I wanted to talk about today is the Deutsch-Jozsa algorithm. And it's an extension of something we talked about before, which is the Deutsch algorithm. But it's a lot more impressive because it works for arbitrary number of qubits, so input states. So the Deutsch algorithm that we talked about, we had a one-qubit function. So you had a function that just took 0 to 1, 2, 0 to 1. And we showed that from one query to the oracle, we could determine whether this function was constant or balanced. Well, in this case, we now have a function from n qubits to 1 qubit. And we can still do it in just one query. So the idea So x is now an n-bit string, so some string of zeros and ones. And we have some function, f of x. And we don't know what the function is, but we have some black box for calculating it, or for applying it. And we're told that f of x is either constant or balanced. So that is, it evaluates to either 0 or 1 for each x. And we're told that either it's all zeros and all ones, or it's half zeros and half ones. Okay, so classically, we would need to make 2 to the n over 2 plus 1 queries. And the reason is, to be absolutely sure. So we have some function, and you evaluate it at a given for a given input, and you get a 0 or a 1. If you evaluate again and you get the opposite, then you know for sure it's not constant, right? So you can say for sure that it's balanced. But in the worst case, you would have to check half of the qubits, and you would keep getting all this, or half of the bits, rather. And you would keep getting zeros or ones. And then you need to check that one more to check whether it's the same or different, to say whether it's constant or balanced. OK, is that clear? OK, yeah, sorry. So the idea is that, so suppose we just check sequentially through all the possible values that f can have. So it's a, first of all, it's an n-bit function. So there are 2 to the n possible inputs. Okay. So x can go from 0 to 2 to the n. And I check what f of 0 is, and I get, let's say I get 0. Okay. And then I check what f of 1 is, and let's say I get 0 again, and so on. Well, I want to know whether the function will always evaluate to 0, or whether half the time it'll evaluate to 1 and half the time to 0. So in the worst case, I would check up to f of 2 to the n over 2. So I check half of my inputs, and I keep getting zeros. But I still can't say with certainty whether the next one won't be 1 or not. Okay, so then I check the next one. And I get whatever, 0 or 1. And then you can say that the function is constant or balanced. Okay. So in the worst case, you really need to check it this many times, 2 to the n over 2 plus 1. Of course, you probably don't need to check it that many times. Chances are you'll get a 1 somewhere in one of the other ones that you check. Okay. So what about quantum mechanically? In the quantum case, I have some register which has n qubits in it. And then I have some one extra qubit to store the result. And the black box, the thing that evaluates the function, works as follows. So it's a unit array which works on the input states x and y. And it takes them to this state. So you feed in your state x and y, it evaluates f of x, and it puts it in the second qubit, in the last qubit. So, for example, so the x state is a state of n qubits. So, for example, if we put in the zero state, well, the zero state comes out unchanged, but the auxiliary qubit now has f of zero in there. Okay, and similarly for any other input x. So for any input x, f of x can be just 0 or 1. So let's suppose that it's 0. So what this means is the following. So if f of x is equal to 0, this is modular addition, modulo 2. So if f of x is equal to 0, it does nothing. Y is still just y. And if f of x is equal to 1, it essentially flips y. Because so again, we're going to be using superposition states. So what I want to know is what happens if y is in a superposition state. So suppose I input the following. Like that. So let's see what happens to the superposition state. So we saw this idea when we looked at the Deutsch algorithm. If I input this superposition, if f of x is equal to 0, then this state is still just 0 minus 1. And if f of x is equal to 1, then this is 1, and 1 plus 1 is 0. So I get this. And finally, this is just minus the state that I put in. Okay. So it picks up a minus 1 if f of x is equal to 1, and it doesn't pick up any phase if f of x is equal to 0. So I can write this more concisely as minus 1 to the power of f of x. Okay. So the idea is, just as in the simpler case we considered of the Deutsch algorithm, we input a superposition state. So this is the circuit diagram. And where's my pointer? This is just denoting that there's really n qubits here. So this is the n qubit zero state. And this is my auxiliary qubit, which starts off in the one state. First of all, the Hadamard on the one state is what takes it to this superposition that I've been talking about. Okay. And the Hadamard on the zero state, well, let's look at what that does. So now I have this notation just means this Hadamard acting on each of the n qubits. So acting on the zero state. What that really means is just okay. So it acts independently on each of the qubits. And what this does is takes each of the qubits to the superposition 0 plus 1. And so on. So if I take the tensor product out of all of those, well, let's consider the case of just two qubits. Okay, so applying the Hadamard separately on the two qubits that start in the computational basis, I end up with a superposition of all the computational basis states of two qubits. Okay, so the 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. And in the n qubit case, it's exactly the same thing that happens. So this is just an equal superposition of all possible 2 to the n. computational basis states. Okay. So well, you can see because there's equal amplitude in the zeros and ones of each one. So when you take all the tensor products out, when you multiply out all the tensor products, there's an equal amplitude in all the permutations. Okay. So that stage for n qubits. Becomes this stage, where now x is just is a n-bit string. So this is, so in the two-state case, here we have all the possible combinations, and in the n-state case, we have all the possible n-bit combinations. Okay. So now we go to the black box, which is represented here by the UF. Okay, so after the two Hadamards, this is the state of the system. And now I apply the function and see how that evaluates. Well, we've shown that applying the function to x times the superposition state just brings out a phase factor depending on the value of f of x. Okay. So now this becomes minus 1 to the power f of x. Okay. And now you can see if all the f of x's are the same, so either all equal to 0 or all equal to 1, then this superposition state is just the same as this one that I had before I did anything to it, okay, with maybe a phase factor at the point. If half of these are 0 and half of them are 1, then half of the terms in the superposition have a minus attached to it. And that state is orthogonal to this one. Okay. So if half of these have a minus and I take the inner product of this state with that one, then I get a 0. Right? So depending on whether the function is balanced or constant, the final state is projected into two orthogonal possibilities. And then with just one measurement, you can tell whether the function is constant or balanced. Okay. So explicitly, at the end, you do another Hadamard. Okay, so we have 1 over 2 to the n. And we have the other state, but we don't really care about that anymore. So this is the one that we're going to measure. So now we need to know how the Hadamard acts on all of these basis states x. So if you bear with me for a little while. So on one qubit, we had fade to zero. Like this. So this is just another way of writing exactly that. So now x could be either 0 or 1. And if it's 0, this is a plus. We get exactly what I had there. And if it's 1, this is a minus. So I get exactly what I had there. And this can be written more concisely in this form. So z now is we're summing over z being 0 and 1. And we get exactly the state back. And the reason I'm writing in this way is just to show what happens in the n-dimensional case, or the n-cubic case, rather. So the n Hadamard gates acting on the n qubits. So x now is made up of n different qubits. Okay. And when I act on each of them with this gate, then well, I can just replace here. Okay, so I'm just expanding that out. And then there's a bunch more terms. Like that. So it's just a bit of algebra to keep track of. Okay, so just combining all that together in this form, where now I'm considering the x's and the z's to be vectors. So this x dot z is just x1, z1 plus x2, z2, and so on. Okay. So the state of the system after, so up to just before the last Hadamard gates was. Was like this. And then with the state of the auxiliary qubit, okay, I'll write that. So now I apply this final Hadamard. So now I have minus 1 to the f of x and minus 1 to the x up there. Okay. So that was just tracing through the state of the system all the way through the circuit. And now finally we measure in the computational basis at the end. Okay, so if well, what's the probability that I measure and find all the qubits in the state 0? We all finish with a bit of the top. Can I pull it down to here? Okay. Well, what's the amplitude in the 0 state? It's the overlap of 0, 0. With this state here. Which is, so only the term where z is equal to 0 we keep, and we get 1 over 2 to the n, the sum over x. And z is equal to 0, so this term goes, and I just get left with the f of x. Like that. Okay. So now we have that if all of these are the same, then there are 2 to the n contributions of 1 or minus 1. And so it adds up to 2 to the n, and this becomes 1. Okay. So the modulus of that is 1 if it's constant, so if all the f of x's are the same. And if it's balanced, so half of the f of x's are 0 and half of them are 1, then half of these terms are minus 1 and half of them are plus 1. And it's 0. So with just that final measurement, you can determine with certainty whether the function was constant or balanced. So, are there any questions on that? Anything specific?
Couldn't some functions be neither constant nor balanced?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So this works if you're guaranteed that the function is either constant or balanced. If you don't know that, then there are slightly more general things you can do, but you would need more than one query. Okay, so for the two-qubit case, I think one of your problems is concerned with the two-qubit case. Okay, so the other one I wanted to talk about was Grover's algorithm. But there's only 10 minutes left, so I think I'll leave that till the next day. Yeah, I think we'll leave that till the next day rather than rushing it. Okay. So does anyone have any questions on anything we talked about today? So there's a lot of algebra there at the end, probably. This is to go through exactly what the circuit does. Okay, so, and just to remind you, there's more problems online, but there's not that many more. Okay, please do it.